This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This week belonged to the former Massachusetts governor who would be president. At the RNC in Tampa, it was Mitt Romney's big chance to introduce himself and sharpen his attack on President Obama.
This president can tell us that the next 4 years he'll get it right. But this president cannot tell us that you're better off today than when he took office.
And it was a chance for those in Massachusetts who know Romney best to lay out their case to the rest of the nation.
First and foremost, Mitt Romney is a good and honorable man, committed to public service and his country.
Meanwhile, back home in Massachusetts, the race for the U.S. Senate picked up steam and dollars as Democrat Elizabeth Warren rolled out a new ad aimed at women.
Why do women have to fight the same old battles? Women still don't get equal pay for equal work. Republicans blocked that and even pushed a law that could have denied insurance coverage for birth control.
Also, a massive cheating scandal rocks Harvard University.
And a state crime lab in Boston is shut down after evidence is mishandled, raising the possibility that people were wrongly convicted and incarcerated.
So those are some of the this week's top stories that we're going to dig into with our Week in Review panel. And joining us here in the studio, Callum Borchers, political correspondent for the Boston Globe. And welcome to Radio Boston, Callum. Great to see you in the studio.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Also with us, John Carroll, professor of mass communication at Boston University and author of the blogs CampaignOutsider.com and It's Good to Live in a TwoDailyTown.com. Good to see you, John. I'm always worried I'm going to trip up on those two.
No, you did great. And it's good to be here. It's always good to be here.
Well, it's good to see you. Of course, the big story this week, presidential politics, and we'll get to that. But let's start with the shutdown of the Hinton State Laboratory Institute in Boston, which could have huge implications. A little bit of background. This is a crime lab that certifies drug evidence from all across the state. State police now say they shut it down after discovering that a chemist failed to follow proper protocols. And state police say that we're talking about more than just sloppiness here. The allegations include deliberate mishandling of evidence and the likelihood that justice was not served. So here's State Police Superintendent Colonel Timothy Albin.
The ramifications and the reason that we're here today is the potential that we have people incarcerated or been wrongly prosecuted.
So, Callum Borchers, let's start with you. This lab is involved with evidence, literally thousands of convictions. Put the story in perspective for us.
I think it's one that's just going to keep growing, Anthony, to be honest with you. I mean, this is a case of, like you said, it really sort of undermines the public trust in a way, doesn't it? When we, you know, submit evidence and we have these people go on trial, there's a sort of a belief that whatever comes out of the lab is almost irrefutable. And it took a while to develop that confidence. And I think this really undercuts that quite a bit. You're talking about people who might have been wrongly convicted, people who very well might be serving prison right now who really don't belong there. And the reverse is also possible true, that there are people out there who should have gone there instead.
And we've already heard, John, from some defense attorneys that we're going to see a bunch of challenges to these convictions.
Yeah, I saw this on Law and Order about a week ago. This is a classic case of mishandling. But also one of the big questions is, why did it take so long for them to shut this lab down or for them to take any action? They've known about this. This has been an investigation that's been going on since last year. So and the state police who took over the lab only found out a couple of weeks ago. So I think there's been probably a lot of damage done in the interim. And I think they're going to be facing jeopardy in a number of areas. Wrongful convictions, compensatory damages if people have gone to jail when they shouldn't have gone to jail. I think there are all kinds of repercussions to this.
Well, you know, it reminds me of this issue. I mean, when we talk about wrongful convictions, I mean, overall, the criminal justice system does a pretty good job. They usually get it right. But we hear again and again, year after year, stories about bad science, about wrongful convictions. And, you know, we do have this faith in science. And when we hear that there's scientific evidence, but unless that scientific evidence is handled by people with integrity, following proper procedures, it just turns into junk science.
I think one thing is important to keep in perspective here is that the science itself is not necessarily flawed. It's a personnel issue.
The personnel, right.
And so I think that's important to bear in mind as well. So this shouldn't undermine our confidence in lab testing per se. But what it does reinforce is the tremendous importance of getting good people in there who are going to operate in good faith. And as John said, this was going on for a long time. I believe the woman who is cited here has been working at the lab since 2003. I mean, this is a long, long period of time.
Yeah, and also, I mean, the other problem is you need this kind of evidence when you go into court. It's been shown that the CSI effect is something that has had a real impact on juries and a real impact on lawyers and the way they prosecute their cases. If you don't have this information, number one, you know, that makes it much harder for you to get a conviction. And if people start to lose faith in it, then you sort of it's sort of double jeopardy for the prosecution.
Another thing that strikes me is how much work goes through one single lab. I mean, this lab is processing criminal evidence from pretty much all over the state, from police departments all over the state. I wonder if this raises an argument for spreading the work out, or I'm not sure, but I just reading the coverage, actually the excellent coverage that the Globe did, Callum, this was a question that sort of came to my mind.
It's an excellent point, and I think it certainly does raise that question, because you end up in a spot where all your eggs are not perhaps in one basket, but many of them are. And if at least if you spread things around and a scandal like this broke, you would be able to say, well, it affected 15% of our cases or whatever. I mean, now you're talking about half. If I were to say that there would be something positive that could come out of this, I was chatting with a soon-to-be brother-in-law of mine who's got a criminal justice degree, and he said that there are sometimes sort of a culture within, you know, the criminal justice system that you rely too much on this type of evidence, on lab testing and whatnot. And perhaps it will remind folks of the importance of sort of good old-fashioned police work, that you need to have other types of evidence as well to put people away, just in case the lab doesn't prove to be infallible.
Well, Governor Deval Patrick calls the alleged violations deeply troubling. Attorney General Martha Coakley has launched a criminal investigation, so a lot more to come out of this story in the weeks or possibly the months ahead. There's a lot of political news to talk about, and we're going to talk about that in a moment. We're going to take a very quick break. John Carroll, Callum Borchers, stand by. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back to talk about all the political news from Tampa and across Massachusetts this week. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. And we're back with our Week in Review. And with us are John Carroll, mass communications professor at BU, and Callum Borchers, political correspondent for the Boston Globe. And gentlemen, let's move on to politics and Mitt Romney and this week's RNC. Last night in Tampa, it was the former Massachusetts governor's big moment and big speech to convention delegates. Here he is.
Now is the moment when we can stand up and say, I'm an American. I make my destiny. We deserve better. My children deserve better. My family deserves better. My country deserves better.
So, Callum, if one of the challenges facing Romney this week was to introduce himself more fully and really fill out that picture of who Mitt Romney is, how do you think he did overall?
I think he hit some major points. He had to sort of focus a little bit more on biography. Now, it's important to remember that so far over the summer, we've seen much more ad spending by the Obama campaign, by the Romney campaign, and they've really done, I think a lot of folks would say, a pretty effective job of characterizing Mitt Romney. So this was his chance with an unfiltered audience to really redefine himself, and I think he did a pretty effective job there. He also struck a more optimistic tone, I think, than we've heard in the past. You know, a lot of the campaign has been negative on both sides, and one of the criticisms levied against him is that he is running as the non-Obama candidate. But of course, you have to be more than that. People want to cast a lever for something and not just against something. And I think that he achieved a little bit of that as well. I think sort of the missing piece that he'll have to fill in over the next 2 months is more specific. So we heard just in that clip talking about a better America, a stronger America. The biggest question in voters' minds, of course, is how precisely are you going to do that?
Right. John Carroll.
Well, I think it's remarkable, to use a favorite word of Mitt Romney's, that this is a guy who's been running for president for 6 years and he's still reintroducing himself to the public. I mean, he went into an extensive autobiographical presentation last night, and I think that's... It shouldn't have to be that way, number one. Number two is he's got all these surrogates vouching for the fact that you can trust Mitt Romney. When you can't generate that kind of trust on your own, I mean, that's an essential flaw, I think, that you have in your candidate and in your campaign.
Well, let me pick up on that theme, because one of the big themes from last night and throughout the entire weeks was hearing from folks who know Romney well. We heard, of course, from his wife, Anne, who gave a very personal speech about Romney as a husband and father. Last night, we heard from Lieutenant Governor, from former Lieutenant Governor Carrie Healey, who called him first and foremost a good and honorable man, and then said this about his performances as governor. Let's listen.
We cleared out regulations on small businesses, and we cut taxes 19 times. And as a result, unemployment dropped to only 4.7%. And unlike President Obama, Governor Romney's economic policies were rewarded with a credit upgrade.
Former Lieutenant Governor Carrie Healey speaking yesterday and last night in Tampa. Callum, you know, talk about this. Democrats have been pounding Romney's career at Bain Capital. Here's a loyal lieutenant governor making a case for him as an effective chief executive. First of all, good political strategy, and second of all, was it accurate?
A couple of things. I think it's a good political strategy in that the Romney argument about his record in Massachusetts is a little bit more straightforward than the Obama argument against it. And by that, I mean you can point to simple numbers. People understand unemployment figures. Mm-hmm. And you say, okay, 4.7% unemployment. That's good. The Obama campaign has been talking about, you know, the record of job creation. And you say, well, you know, they ranked 47th out of 50 in job creation. But as Carrie Healey points out, you know, when you've got unemployment under 5%, that's generally considered full employment. So it would only be natural that perhaps you wouldn't grow quite as fast. There's a little bit more nuance there. As far as the accuracy goes, you know, one of the big flaws, of course, I think, is to lay at the feet of President Obama the responsibility for that credit downgrade. I mean, if you look at S&P, for instance, they specifically blame, congressional Republicans, the gridlock in Congress for that downgrade. It had less, I think, to do with the president than it did with them.
And John, what did you hear in the kind of testimony from people like Carrie Healey?
I think I heard a campaign and a party that was trying to borrow credibility from other people. I think that this backstory of Mitt Romney, and I could be wrong about this, but I'm pretty sure that 4.7% unemployment was higher than the national average, that the national average was lower for unemployment. So it's all context. It's all about, you know, which statistics you trot out and which ones you hold back. But I think overall, the procession of people who know Romney and who can testify to his success and to his reliability, and I think that's pretty standard, but I just think it was a little more urgent in this case because of the situation he finds himself in with relation to his public image and how he has conducted his campaign so far. Callum's right. Mm-hmm. You know, he hasn't gone out and said anything positive about himself, and neither have the super PACs. So I think he's a little late to the party on this.
Well, another thing that I was struck by last night was the sort of elder statesman, I'm sort of disappointed with what's going on. He sort of almost took a gentle, sort of reproachful tone toward President Obama. When he was first elected, he talked about how people were excited, and understandably so, but now we're disappointed. Romney says America has been patient. They supported the president in good faith, but now it's time to turn the page.
This president can ask us to be patient. This president can tell us it was someone else's fault. This president can tell us that the next 4 years he'll get it right. But this president cannot tell us that you're better off today than when he took office.
So, Callum, that question works so well. I'm thinking of Ronald Reagan back in 1980. Are you better off than you were 4 years ago?
Right.
Is this a question that can work for Mitt Romney?
I think it can, because he needs to be careful in his negative attacks of not attacking the president's character, right? Because the president remains personally very popular. Every poll indicates that. And so you've seen that sort of talk now coming out of the campaign, I think, from the Romney side a little bit more lately, right? Where they say, you know, really nice guy, great family man, gave it his best effort, mm-hmm. but he just hasn't lived up to the promise that we all had in him. And he's sort of lumping himself in that group, right, as someone who was hoping for more out of this president 4 years ago. Whether that's true or not, who knows? But that is sort of the sentiment that he's going with. And so I think that type of argument can be effective for him. Certainly the economy can be the real weakness, and that's where he's really going to try and focus over the next 2 months.
And John Carroll, your view, because I guess the pushback on that argument was that Obama could point out that 4 years ago this country was on the brink of financial ruin. Still big problems out there, but a long way from financial ruin.
Right. I don't think you can go to that well too often, but I think there were two real knee slappers last night. One was that I wanted President Obama to succeed. I had a little trouble believing that one. And the other was that we all came together after he was elected, because that's how we roll in America. That another thing, that it has been more obstructionist in Washington, D.C. than it has been in many years. And the listeners can assign the blame wherever they want. But the fact is that they didn't come together after Obama was elected. So this whole scenario, he's setting up sort of a straw man here and a false premise that he's basing his argument on. And I think it is delicate for them to figure out how to tell people they made a mistake. You know, they don't want to alienate people by saying, boy, you know, you were really dumb to elect this guy president. But, you know, that's the case that they have to make and the proposition they have to sell.
Well, let's move on to the battle for the Senate in Massachusetts. And, of course, this is one of the most watched races around the country. And so what do we make of Senator Scott Brown having virtually no role at this week's RNC? He was absent for most of the week, but showed up in Tampa yesterday and explained his low profile this way.
Well, I have my own race. I have my own life, as you know. I have. There's only so many days in the year to be a dad and a husband and a soldier and a senator and then run for re-election.
Callum, what do you think of that response?
Well, I think it was about as smart as he could play it, actually, to be honest with
yeah.
you. Truthfully, I think that what we've seen is an emergence in this campaign of a savvy politician in Scott Brown. You know, he's no longer the new guy here. And by that, I mean, if you look at the attacks that Elizabeth Warren has levied against him in recent weeks, it's largely been an attempt to lump him in with the GOP at large, right? Because it was Scott Brown who came out and wrote a letter to Ryan Priebus saying, I don't agree with the strong anti-abortion plank in the platform, for instance, and Elizabeth Warren's counterargument as well. If you elect him, he's part of the larger Republican Party. It will help advance their overall agenda. And so by keeping, you know, sort of an arm's length distance from the Republican convention this week, I think he's making it harder for Elizabeth Warren to lump him in with that group. I think it's a smart play.
Yep. Smart politics on his part, John?
Yeah. I think the one thing he left out was he had to rearrange his sock drawer. I think that that one should have ranked pretty high up there, actually. I think it's exactly right. This guy is an independent voice. He's always presented himself as an independent voice. He's been very savvy and strategic about where he's diverted from party ideology. And I think that he wants to keep it that way because it gives him a better chance at the independent vote. It gives him a better chance, in this case, at the women's vote, which is something that's turned into a really hot football and political football at this point.
And speaking of that, Brown's opponent, Elizabeth Warren, has launched a new ad this week directed at female voters. Here's a brief snippet.
We're still fighting to protect a woman's right to choose nearly 40 years after Roe versus Wade, and we could be just one Supreme Court justice away from losing it. How can this be happening in 2012?
So now in that ad, Warren does not mention Brown by name. And in fact, Brown favors legalized abortion. He's tried to make the point that he doesn't agree with the National Republican Party on this issue, as the point you made, Callum. But what do you make of Elizabeth Warren's ad there?
I'd say also a smart play. I mean, I think that the next few months or a couple of months will determine which is more successful, obviously. But for Warren, I think this is a very smart play because there is such a concern, I think, among some folks that the Republicans in Congress are becoming very obstructionist and that they are perhaps more conservative in some ways than they've been several decades ago. I mean, we've heard folks in the Republican Party call this their most conservative platform in modern history. So the more that she can lump Scott Brown in with that group, even at the moments where he tries to raise his hand and say, hold on, I don't quite agree with that particular element, I think that the better off she will be.
And it's a bit of a high wire act because, you know, she has to worry about Scott Brown, you know, pulling on the cardigan and going into his kitchen and making one of those ads where he says, isn't it sad the way people are attacking other people? And which worked really well for him in 2010 against Martha Coakley. I mean, there's a line that you don't want to cross with Scott Brown because he has an already established image. And Elizabeth Warren is still establishing her image. She hasn't quite done it yet. And I think that you run too counter to the public perception of Scott Brown, and you're going to run into some kind of backlash from the public.
Well, these are great points, and whether it's related to this next point that I wanted to bring up, and that is a new poll out this week from the Democratic-leaning Public Policy Polling has Scott Brown leading Warren by 5 points, 49 to 44 among likely voters. That's the biggest lead so far. And what's interesting, Brown has a big advantage among those all-important independents. So here we are just a couple of months to go to Election Day. The conventions are almost behind us. What's the state of the Warren-Brown race, Callum?
Well, I think that that captures it pretty well. And what I said a moment ago about, you know, Brown sort of emerging as a savvy politician here, I think we saw a great example of that this week, right, where we had that Republican, you know, cameraman who was following Elizabeth Warren around right at that event down on the Vineyard, and he gets shoved by the cab driver and drops the camera. And Scott Brown yesterday writes a letter to this guy's town saying, don't take away his cabbie license. What he did was wrong, but I don't think that, you know, throwing him out of his livelihood is productive right now. He made a mistake. I understand it. I mean, smart play.
Savvy, and as
John said, this is only contributes to his image as someone who's sort of an independent voice, someone who can be reasonable, someone who's not going to be vindictive. And what he's trying to do is paint Elizabeth Warren as someone who's very, very negative.
And I think one of the things you have to worry, that poll has him 5 points ahead. If he pulls much further ahead, one of the things I'm curious to see is, does the People's Pledge to keep third-party groups out hold up, or does it get blown up by by the Warren forces? I mean, it's a risky thing to do. There's no question about it. But the question would be a calculation on whether this would be a short-term hit to her image or a long-term hit, and would it be outweighed by the advantage of bringing in more money and somebody from the outside to do the attacking so she can stay positive. So I think that, you know, that's one of the factors that'll be interesting to keep an eye on.
Really interesting to watch. Well, we've got time now to move on to our hubbub, that story that sort of didn't make it quite above the fold this week. Magna, your hubbub for this week in the news.
My hubbub actually comes from one of John's blogs,
Campaign Outsider. This is cross-promotion. I love this.
Exactly. So I was looking at it today, and you noticed an article in the Wall Street Journal about Asheville, North Carolina, debating how weird is too weird, because they were having, I guess, a topless rally, and people wanted to keep Asheville weird. And you asked this question of, why is there no Keep Boston Weird campaign? And my answer to that is A, it's not like Portlandia with Keep Portland Weird, and B, we want the weird people to stay away, don't we?
I thought you were going to say we're already weird in our own way.
No, that's true.
I don't know. All I know is the commenters on my blog wanted me to stay away, basically. So that didn't go over very well at all.
Yeah, so maybe out there, if you want to start, John Carroll says we need to Keep Boston Weird campaign.
All right, I'm in favor of that. Callum, your hubbub for the week.
And my hubbub comes from the American Journal of Transplantation, that, you know, enthralling publication that we all read every month. And John, we're just meeting now. If I needed a kidney, would you be willing to help me out?
I don't know. I'd have to check with the missus.
Okay, well, what if I raised the stakes and gave you a tax break because you gave me that kidney?
What about some free texting minutes? Could I get that, too?
Perhaps that's negotiable, but what I can tell
for
you
a
is...
For a tax break, I'll give you my kidney.
Oh, there you go.
Excellent.
But the thing is, Anthony, you're actually in the minority. According to this study in the American Journal of Transplantation, there are 17 states right now, including Massachusetts, by the way, in which you can get a tax deduction for donating an organ or bone marrow, for instance. But it's not working. The incentive isn't kicking up the bank of organ donors one bit.
I wonder why.
Well, you know what's interesting is what the researchers concluded was that the tax breaks that folks were getting were only worth about $1,000, and the actual cost of them going in for the medical care was more than that. So they were actually still coming out in a net negative, and that might have something to do with it.
That, I would say, would have a lot to do with it. John Carroll, your hubbub.
So, completely defying the laws of probability, Elizabeth Warren has been writing a column for the Boston Herald this week chronicling the Republican National Convention. And you would think, after being tuned up on a daily basis by the Herald for months and months now, that's the last place she would go. But basically, I can tell you a couple of things, because nobody wants to talk about it to me. She's not being paid, although these are like infomercials. She's getting free infomercials, because all it is railing against Scott Brown and Mitt Romney. Today's headline is, Romney gives breaks to the big guys. You know, stop the presses, right? So that's one thing. And the other thing I can tell you is that I can't tell you that Scott Brown is going to be covering the Democratic National Committee, because the Herald won't return my calls, but I believe that he probably is. Otherwise,
That would only be fair.
Yeah, and I think that they wouldn't do a one-sided deal like this.
All right, well, here's my hubbub, and it probably sort of breaks the rules of what a hubbub should be, but I've got to go back to last night's convention and ask you both about Clint Eastwood. Okay. Now, what was going on there? For listeners that missed it, he conducted a mock interview with an empty chair that supposedly contained President Obama. And he said some really strange things. Here we go. Let's listen.
What? What do you want me to tell Romney? I can't tell him to do that. That can't do that to himself.
And on, but I have a couple of questions, guys. I mean, what were they thinking? Did these speeches get vetted? And was Clint Eastwood working for Romney or for Obama? It was really unclear to me at that point.
This is what I used to work in the ad business. This is what we used to refer to as a concept with a capital K. I mean, I don't know how this came up. Clint Eastwood did more damage to himself last night terms of his image than you could ever imagine him doing.
I can only imagine that somebody was afraid to ask him to see the speech in advance because it seemed off the cuff, and I can't imagine that anybody who saw it in advance would have given it the green light.
Maybe he thought someone was actually in the chair.
That's the scariest possibility. Yeah, maybe he had a Harvey moment.
Callum Borchers, political correspondent for the Boston Globe, thanks so much for coming in. Have a great weekend.
You too. It was fun. Thanks for having me.
And John Carroll, professor of communications at Boston University and author of a number
of blogs
with really long names. Thank you. Have a great weekend.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, Harvard University is hit by a massive student cheating scandal. We'll ask if the pressure to succeed is pushing students to cut corners. Stay with us. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.